Tas asmcha ke'ocha yadayoy.
Rabbi Reis, Yadin Yadin Chabura.
You shouldn't make yourself like a lawyer. It sounds like being a lawyer is pretty bad. That's something that is condemned and is criticized so soundly by the Mishnah. But what is this talking about? Is this really a condemnation towards the practice of being Orchei Dayanim, or just for maybe certain court officials, maybe for judges, but Dayanim, to act as Orchei Dayanim? So the Rashi, in his Perush on the Mishnah, actually gives you all of the different approaches to what this in fact means. Bearing in mind, of course, Rabbeinu Yonah explains that all mili de'avos is mili de'chassidusa. It's not necessarily an absolute prohibition, even if it's something which is disfavored to begin with. But he says, number one, this is an admonition against the dayanim that they shouldn't act as orchei dayanim. They shouldn't advocate on behalf of the parties. Shulti Gibarim says this very explicitly in terms of the halachic application of the Mishnah, that the dayanim are not supposed to tilt the balance, they're not supposed to show their hand, they're not supposed to facilitate the presentation of either side as at least a matter of general presumption. Number two, that a dayan, this is a very interesting twist, because this finds some sort of expression in the halachos that we were discussing last time about a person who discusses a case with a dayan before the case goes to trial. But Rashi gives the pshat that a dayan should stay away from the people who will come to him and say, you know, I have a dispute. I don't intend to ever bring it to you, but I know you're a dayan, and I'd like you to advise me as to how I should go about strategizing with respect to the way that I act towards the other party so that I will prevail. For you to, you know, give a sense to me of the merits of my position. These are ma'asim b'chol yom. There's no dayan who doesn't get calls like this all the time. Rashi gives this as the second pshat as to what the Mishnah is saying. The third pshat as to what the Mishnah is saying is our issue, which is that it's improper to serve as advocates for the parties, who advise the parties, who give them etzos as to how they can skew their presentations in their favor, and to be involved, misa'abir ariv shalolo, to be involved in cases that don't involve you, to assist a particular party in their presentation of the case, either in preparing the presentation of the case or presenting their case before the dayanim. So the question is whether this is something that is in fact usur, whether it is in fact something which is not doable. So I'd like to break this down based on the comments of the Batanura and the Rambam into two different types of situations. One type of situation is a situation in which you are counseling a side in terms of how to go about dealing with a current dispute, in which you give them advice, halakhic advice. That's what the lawyers nowadays do on an ongoing basis with their clients. I was both a litigator and I was a transactional attorney. When I was a litigator, I dealt with the case after everything had already happened, and there was a case of assisting the party in presenting the claims before a court. When I was a transactional attorney, I was helping the parties to strategize with respect to how they would go about their business transactions so it would be the most favorable for them from a business perspective and from a legal perspective. These are two very distinctly different roles that a lawyer plays, but according to the Meforshim, both of them are alluded to in the statement of Atas Asmcha Kirochei HaDayanim. Even if it's referring to the judges, the Bartanur and the Rambam argue about whether it's referring to somebody who is acting in this fashion and counseling a party during a dispute, during a transaction, telling them how to behave, or whether it's somebody who's counseling parties about how to present, I think the Rambam says, how to present their tainus in front of a judge after the dispute has already played out. And it's important to look at each of these categories differently, because the objections and issues that relate to one don't necessarily relate to the other, and they really are dealt with differently by the poskim even though the term of Orchei HaDayanim might be used with respect to both capacities, they really are two totally separate and distinct discussions. The discussions in the Shulchan Aruch are found in Siman Yud Zayin, Orchei HaMishpat, and then they're found in Simanim Kof Chav Beis, Kof Chav Gimel, in Dinei Harshah later on. The discussion in Siman Yud Zayin is really applicable, at least the Piskei Tshuva's discussion, is applicable to the first category of those who are rendering advice, and the discussion of really serving as what might be called a Toein Rabbani, as somebody who is presenting the case in front of the Dayanim, is really the discussion, it's found a little bit in the Sma here in Siman Yud Zayin, it's found mostly later on in Dinei Harsha, in the second Chelek of Choshen Mishpat. So let's first turn to the first category. So, the Gemaras in Ksuvos, there are a number of Gemaras in Ksuvos that talk about situations where some big Gemara, advised a party who was in the midst of some type of a dispute, and then slapped himself on the head afterwards and said, Gevalt, what have I done? Asino asmenu ke'orchei adoyanim. Indicating, it's not such a good thing. There are two such stories in the Gemara in Ksuvos. The first story relates to Rabbi Yochanan, who had a relative. This is the Gemara in Ksuvos and Daf Nun Beis Amud Beis. Had a lot of second marriage problems that occurred, it seems, according to the Gemara. All of the problems seem to arise from second marriages. I don't know. Because you have children from the first marriage, and they're afraid of losing their inheritance in the second marriage. So here there was a relative of Rabbi Yochanan, whose father, I guess, had married a second time, and then the father passed away, and his wife, Pashas and the Sugya is that the wife was not this fellow's mother, the wife was exhausting all of the assets of the estate for her medical care. Because she's entitled to have an unlimited amount of medical care under the laws of the ksuva, without it being considered a collection of her ksuva. Unless it's a refuah sheyesh lakitzva. Unless it's a refuah, it's a medical treatment which can be quantified in some fashion. If it can be quantified, then it's taken off of the ksuva, and it's finite, and once it's finished, then she would have no further rights. So this relative was eating away the assets of the estate every single day because she needed serious medical care. She had a chronic condition, apparently, every single day. And this relative came complaining to Rabbi Yochanan, and Rabbi Yochanan said, I have a great idea. Go to a doctor. You know, there are doctors who specialize in these things, right? You know, go to a doctor who will provide a good kitzva, quantification of the medical care that she needs, and then that's all she'll be entitled to, and you won't have to worry about her depleting the assets of the estate anymore. Then Rabbi Yochanan said, Asinu etzmenu ke'orchei hadayanim. So the Gemara says, okay, that's nice, but obviously, originally, he thought it was okay. So why did he originally think it was okay to render the advice and only at the end decide it wasn't okay? So the Gemara says, well, Meikara, Kasavar, Bimsachal Tisalim, that he relied on the Pasuk in Yeshayahu that you're supposed to help out a relative. It's a mitzvah on some level. You're supposed to help out a relative, so therefore it was appropriate for him to be involved. Lebesof-sover, Adam Chashiv Shiny. And then at the end, he came to the conclusion that it was not proper because he was an Adam Chashiv. And then the second case, the Gemara has similar fact pattern with respect to Rav Nachman, on the Gemara in Daf Pehe Amud Beis. Rav Nachman also had a relative where there was a the mother had sold her ksuva b'toras hana. She had sold the present value of the ksuva to some lochim. Then she was divorced from her husband. So upon divorce, she would have been entitled to the ksuva, but she sold the ksuva. So the lekuchos would then have collected the ksuva, but I guess before there was an opportunity for the lekuchos to collect the ksuva, for her to collect the ksuva, she died. And the lekuchos, the person who inherited her, was her daughter, because the husband doesn't inherit after a divorce, so the daughter would inherit everything. So lekuchos came to collect from the daughter. And the daughter came to Rav Nachman for advice. She didn't want to lose the money. So Rav Nachman said, well, the best way for you not to lose the money is if the money stays in your father's estate, and then when your father dies eventually, you will, I guess she was an only child, you will inherit from your father, and this way you will be able to keep the ksuva. But how are you going to do that? The way to do that is mocher, you know, shtachov machlo, you know, machol, that if a person, even if they sold a debt, they still have the right to cancel the debt afterwards, to forgive the debt afterwards. So he recommended to the daughter that she forgive the debt. Question mechanically how it works. She's going to forgive the debt, the mother, whatever. Which she somehow she would have the ability to forgive the debt. And once she would forgive the debt, then Lukukos would be out of luck. The ksuva money would stay in her father's possession, and she would eventually get it down the road when her father would die. Really a brilliant, brilliant suggestion. But Rav Nachman concluded, oy voy voy, what have I done? Asino asmenu karochaya dayanim. And the Gemara has mamish exactly the same shakotayu, what may karak my kasover, myself my kasover. First he thought of himself chol tisalim, then he concluded adam choshev shiny. So there's a question which is raised in the Piskei Tshuva as to whether the rendering of advice would be permissible to somebody who's not an Adam Chashuv if the person was not a family member. It appears pretty clear from the Gemaras that if the person is a family member, then it would have been perfectly okay for Rabbi Yochanan and Rabbi Nachman respectively to have rendered this type of advice. And only because they were an Adam Chashuv, they were an important, prestigious, role model type of personality. So this type of involvement in other people's disputes was too unseemly for their status and stature. But otherwise, it would have been perfectly okay. So the Bach says, well, clearly he wouldn't have been involved even without the Adam Chashuv consideration, if not for the consideration of Sachol Tisalim. So therefore, for a non-family member, one really can't provide this type of counsel. And the Tosas Yontif says otherwise. The Tosas Yontif says he thinks that if the person's not an Adam Chashuv, then it should be permissible across the board. But the Piskei Tshuva doesn't note this, but the Tosas Yontif at the end of his discussion notes that his reading is not entirely consistent with the Pashtus of the Gemara. He could certainly see the other side. The Piskei Tshuva says that, he does not. The Piskei Tshuva says that also leans in that direction, that the Bach seems to be more mistaver. So it comes out that if you assume like the Bach, outside of a litigation, we're not talking about in front of the courtroom right now and whether the person can be a Tohen Rabbani or a lawyer presenting the arguments, just in terms of assisting somebody who's in the midst of a dispute and giving them advice that would enable them to acquire an advantage over the other side. So the simple indication of the Gemara is that this is something which is at least disfavored. Disfavored to such a degree that it steps outside of the bounds of the Mili de Chasidusa, Pirkei Avos, into a discussion in the Gemara and Ksuvos, and then into a discussion by the Piskei Tshuva on some serious halacha l'maisa level. The only thing is that even this particular notion is not absolute, because the Gemara in Ksuvos has another case, which is on Daf Pei Vav Amud Aleph, in which there's a similar fact pattern, only it doesn't have the same unhappy ending. At least in terms of anybody retracting from the advice. This case also involved Rav Nachman, and it also involved a relative. And here, the case was that there was, again, a second marriage, and the wife of the second marriage had a very healthy appetite, and she was, for the sake of her mizonos, forcing the husband to deplete all of his assets, and was literally eating him out of house and home. And the Yorshim got worried that they're going to be deprived of their entire Yerusha while this the second wife keeps on stuffing herself. So Rav Nachman advised them. He said, well, you know what? This is what I recommend. I recommend that this is Nundal and Amud Beis. I recommend, said Rabbi Yochanan, Izilu ve'amu leila buchan the niyachid la aro the mizonim. Suggest to your father, he said, that he set aside a particular parcel of land for the kesuva, for the mizonos. Excuse me, that there should be a parcel of land that is designated. This is the only asset from which she would be allowed to collect to collect money, to reimburse her or to pay for the mizonos that she needed to take for herself. And once she would exhaust the value of this property, she wouldn't be entitled to any more mizonos. In this way, all of the other properties of the estate would be safeguarded. And here, there's absolutely no posefer mitzav tzeif. There's no mention of Rav Nachman slapping himself in the head and saying, "Oy, what did I did? Asinu asmenu k'rochay dayanim." So Tosus asks the question, and Tosus says, why over here is it not a problem of asinu asmenu k'rochay dayanim? And Tosus says something very interesting. He says, "Afal gav le'el nischard Rabbi Yochanan mashi sianetza." Even though earlier we find that Rabbi Yochanan regretted having given advice, could have said Rav Nachman also regretted giving advice. Nonetheless, Hacha ein genai. Here, there's no problem, no disgrace. Kimin de bedaita tarlo yom tirtza lekabil. Since that, it was up to her. In other words, there was no unilateral action that was being taken that would irreparably harm this woman. She was of equal bargaining power, you can say. And this was just something that would be given to her for consideration. If she wanted, she could turn it down. She could say no. I'm not going to just segregate a particular asset for my mizonos. I want all the assets for my mizonos. It was a suggestion that could be presented in an atmosphere of equal bargaining power. So according to Tosfos, we see a possible distinction just in terms of the ethics of loyally conduct in general, that if the Gemara is suggesting, which it appears to be, according to the Piskei Tshuva and so forth, that there are times that maybe it is unethical and improper to serve in this type of a loyally capacity, the Gemara is indicating that it's not across the board. That if one is serving in this capacity in a way in which they're giving advice, but the other party is not disadvantaged, the other party is not being exploited, but the other party is of equal bargaining power, and you're just presenting a position that would be advantageous, and they can consider it, and if they think that it's worthwhile for them, they'll accept it, and if they decide that it's not worthwhile for them, they will reject it, but they're of equal bargaining power, then that seems to be, from a halakhic perspective, completely okay. Now, it could be, maybe it's, you still require some sort of a mitzvah element of mibisachol tisalem, because here it was in fact a relative, but I would say that given that, you know, that would have been mitigated by the adam chashuv consideration anyway, right? Because here the person who was giving the advice was Rav Nachman, so it seems that there's more here to justify it than just mibisachol tisalem alone. So mibisachol tisalem plus it was okay anyway, is basically what Tosfos is saying. So that one could here reasonably make an argument that even for a non-relative situation, to serve in that capacity would be ethically proper, or at least ethically neutral. Let's put it that way. Now, the... No, it was, but the point is that if that was the only basis for Heter, that would have been canceled out by Odom Choshev Shaimi, because it was Rav Nachman. Now, the Amish... Yeah.
What you're saying is that we can't even tell us whether this is just a heter for an adam chashuv, or right for an adam chashuv and who's a karov could do it anyway because it's equal.
Right.
Or for even a regular.
Right. So I'm saying that I think you can make a reasonable argument, right, for that reason, because obviously you need something more than mibsaka anyway. So the Yamshel Shom and the Maharshal goes further and says that this was not merely ethically neutral. This actually was ethically proper in sort of an opposite direction. He explains that when is it improper to interpose yourself in a dispute? That's when you are not doing any special mitzvah on behalf of the party that you are helping in terms of their situation. Okay, but if they're in a disadvantaged situation themselves, they are in a position of vulnerability, and you're helping them overcome that position of vulnerability, that is a kiyum of lahatzil ashuk meoshko. Miyadoshko, that's a mitzvah of helping the downtrodden from a vulnerable situation. And here, it was not right of the fact that this woman was unduly being mafsid, the mizonos of the estate. And he says the Marashal, Efshe Deloaba Messian Eitzah, he quotes Tosos, which says maybe even with a consideration of Tosos, if it was just judgment neutral, maybe he would not have given them advice. He labbed the chosid the Havim Sadis Mizoni, if not for the fact that he saw that they were causing a loss of Mizonis. She was eating more than she was entitled to. So it was a mitzvah to help out the Yisomim. But who are then? And he says this is also applicable. Whenever you're saving somebody from loss, whenever you're saving somebody from harm, so then it is perfectly proper to serve in this capacity. That you're allowed to give advice in order to save a person from harm. It could be that what the Maharshal is saying is that, at least for Rav Nachman, as an Adam Chashuv, it still wouldn't have been appropriate for him to get involved if there wasn't some sort of mitzvah component. Maybe if it's not an Adam Chashuv, Tosus' answer is sufficient, that if it's ethically neutral, maybe then it would be perfectly okay as well. Everyone's of equal bargaining power, but maybe for an Adam Chashuv, you need this consideration that you have to be involved in some type of mitzvah, associated work. You're helping the poor, you're helping the vulnerable, you're helping the downtrodden, you're being matzil ashuk miyadoshko, that maybe then it's an absolute requirement from an ethical perspective, as opposed to your regular person, where maybe the teretz of Tosfos would be enough. Now, why do we distinguish in this fashion? If you look at the first two cases, you could reasonably make a case that they weren't ethically neutral. I mean, you had this woman who had a chronic medical condition who needed constant care, and Rabbi Yochanan came up with some sort of a device that would deprive her of the money to pay for that perennial medical condition after a certain point in time, once there was a kitzvah that was quantified for her treatment. So you could argue that that's not, you know, fully in accordance with the high level of the spirit of the law of what we're supposed to be accomplishing through halacha, and therefore maybe that's not ethically neutral, besides the fact that she wasn't of equal bargaining power because she didn't have a choice in the matter. Secondly, in the case of Nachman and the relative who forgave a ksuba, that's a garmi. I mean, come on. If you have a shtachov and you mocha the shtachov, that's a liable act. So you'll say, what was gained if it was a liable act? So there are different terusim that are given. One terus is that she was married, and therefore she didn't have any independent assets that the lukuchos could collect from. Another is that she was a katana, and they couldn't collect from the assets. That's Tosus's answer. A difficult one to understand how she could have engaged in that type of mechila, being a katana, but that's what Tosus says. And a third, that teretz that's given is that, in fact, there was liability, but what's the liability for being mochel ashtar chov? It's not the entire value of the ksuba, it's just what the lukuchos paid for it. So she still was ahead of the curve, because she would still get the difference between whatever they paid for the ksuba and the final amount of the ksuba that she would receive upon the eventual death, lacham eresim, of her father. So, these cases were not necessarily ethically neutral altogether, but what we see is that if I do have ethically neutral type of cases, certainly for a non-Adam Chashuv, then it does seem to be legitimate, even according to these sources, and that seems to exist, I would submit, even outside of the framework of the machlokas between the Bach and the Tosfos Yontif, and there might even be a mitzvah, believe it or not, to serve as an attorney, if it's a type of situation which is lahatzel ashuk miyadoshko. So you go into the business, for example, of being a pro bono attorney, of helping out, you know, those who are in desperate need of legal services because they're being taken advantage of, because they don't know, have proper legal advice to conduct their affairs properly. They're in an unequal bargaining position for their disadvantage. Then there might even be, one can argue, a pialacha, some sort of a mitzvah element, serving as an attorney, certainly for members of the community. I mean, interestingly, the Gidulei Truma takes sort of an opposite, you know, turn in that direction, and says, well, you know when it's okay to serve as an attorney? That's bedafka when you're not doing it pro bono. Now, I think we can fit the Gedulei Truma into this analysis, but the Gedulei Truma says, when is it legitimate to serve as an attorney? If you're getting paid. You have to make sure you're getting paid. You're not getting paid, it might be a problem. But why is it that when it was a relative, it was less of a problem for Rav Nachman and Rabbi Yochanan to consider getting involved? because they had a stake in the matter. So the Gedulei Truma says, the stake doesn't have to be that you're a relative. The stake could just be that you care deeply about the outcome as if you were a relative because you're getting paid for it. So you have a stake in the outcome of the dispute. So as long as you're getting paid, that makes you like family, right? You know, your lawyer is like a member of your family eventually, your lawyer, your accountant, you invite them to the simcha sometimes. So they are like a member of the family, if you pay them. So according to him, it turns out, at least, you know, if you understand that when you're not an Adam Chashuv, you could be a lawyer even perhaps for the non-ethically neutral cases, so if you're getting paid, so that might be a little bit more of a license. However, one could reasonably distinguish and say the cases are not entirely analogous. Why was Mibisachal Otisalim a consideration? Because it was a mitzvah component. It's a mitzvah component that can be outweighed by Adam Chashuv Shiny when there's no independent mitzvah element of what's happening to the person in the course of their dispute, that you have to save them from a disadvantaged situation. Being paid is not a mitzvah, per se. I mean, it's a mitzvah to support your family, but it doesn't convert your status into a mitzvah status just because you're getting paid. So I'm not sure that one has to unequivocally accept the analogy which is drawn by the Gedulei Truma between being a member of the family and actually getting paid. One could argue, based on the reasoning of the Maharshal, that certainly in situations where it's lahatzel oshik miyaroshko, so then the more pro bono your contribution is, and the more generous you are with your time and your fees and so forth, maybe, you know, the bigger a mitzvah it is. Now again, the Gedulei Truma would not necessarily say otherwise. He might say, well, yes, if you're not dealing with an ethically problematic situation, but you're dealing with where you're really helping a disadvantaged party, so, you know, maybe then, you know, you don't need the payment consideration. You could certainly do it pro bono. Yes?
Just coming off the Marshal, you wanted to say that, basically to say that the reason why it was a problem in those cases was because it was a sort of a problematic sort of taking sides, helping one side to get an slightly unfair advantage over the other side, right? Whereas we're in a neutral case, they say maybe this whole problem of asinu fin grocha then doesn't apply. That's what you're suggesting?
Yeah, well, that's what Tosfos certainly suggests. I mean, that's a simple reading of Tosfos.
Well, right,
and even the Maharshal, who doesn't accept Tosfos, might just not accept, or who requires more than that, might just require more than that in a case where I'm not dealing with an Adam Chashuv.
Meaning that according to Tosfos, there's room to say, right, that it's mutter if you're not giving one side an advantage over the other side. It's totally in the haskama of the other side. But the standard, the lawyerly practice, even if it's dealing with sort of, you're not doing anything unfair, but it's not necessarily totally on the agreement of the other side. You are trying to get a better position.
Yeah, but you know what? I think that any type of lawyerly situation where there's kind of, you know, full ability on the other side to negotiate for themselves and to consider the different positions and either accept or reject them, even if you are trying to get the best possible deal for your client, I think it would still fall within that category. I mean, what wouldn't, if you wanted to apply it to kind of modern day, you know, serving as a lawyer or even a Toen Rabbani, I guess, in the context of helping somebody in the midst of a dispute, is if you try to you try to slide something by the other party and blindside them with some advantageous position that you are gaining for yourself, and you're not even giving them a chance to consider it. It's kind of like when I served as a lawyer and we would make changes in documents, and you would, you know, blackline all of the changes of a document, and some of the blackline changes were insignificant terms, and some of the changes that you made in a document were very significant terms, and somebody who's going through 500 pages might not necessarily focus on a couple of words that changed somewhere that could significantly alter the nature of the transaction. So I would view it as a lawyerly responsibility to point out, at least to the other side, the major changes that you are proposing when you make a change in the document. Say, okay, there are lots of changes, I know like there are 3,000, but, you know, here are three that really have significance with respect to, you know, your side or my position. I want you to think them over carefully. Not everybody would do that, but I would routinely, you know, say that this is proper lawyerly ethical conduct. And certainly if somebody is asking me from a halakhic point of view, is there any guidance as to how attorneys should act in this situation? So I would say, yes, we do have guidance, and that is the proper way in which you're supposed to act in that situation in order to ensure equal bargaining power on the part of the other side. Maybe at the end of the day you'll get what you want, maybe you won't get what you want, but you have to go about it in the right fashion and not in a sneaky and devious fashion.
Except for a karuv, and if you're getting paid, you're going to
think of
the truth.
Right, but I think the gedulei truma is problematic, and for a karuv, I guess for a karuv, they would have to be, I guess for a karuv, you can make that argument. The argument you would make according to the gedulei truma is that the other side knows to be out, knows to be aware that you're not looking for out for their benefits because you're getting paid for it by the other side. But I don't think that it's a pashut.
Still, when we learned the Gemara's, this kind of svara occurred to us that these were dafka because these cases were somehow problematic, but we didn't. I was wondering if the poskim, like, because in the Pesachim Truma they don't bring such a chiluk. Meaning, it sounds stimus lashon, that they say. It sounds like in all cases you're not allowed to advise, even a non karuv. Meaning, I was wondering, this is a cheshbon tosis. I was wondering, is it broader than poskim?
Yeah, well, I don't know. The Marashal counts as a posik, so I think it counts. Yeah, I think so. So this is all, with respect to a civil representation. What about criminal representation? Is there a problem there? So I know that Rav Shechter says that there's a problem if you're helping getting a criminal client off on a loophole, then there is a violation of Uviyarta Haram Mikibecha, that you know that somebody committed a crime, and then you represent them in order to get them off of the hook based on a loophole. A search and seizure that didn't have a proper warrant or something like that, as a result, a clear criminal is able to get free. So some say that that's a problem of Riyatzara Mikabecha, that it's much better to serve as a prosecuting attorney than as a defense attorney, right? Because as a prosecutor, first of all, hopefully most of the people you'll be prosecuting are non-Jews, but even if the person's Jewish and it's just the government, the Ritva and the Gemara and Bava Metzia and this Maisa Rabbi Eliezer, Rabbi Shimon, Rabbi Shimon, Rabbi Yossi, who are appointed through Herman of Damalka to serve as a district attorney. So Eliyahu Navi didn't speak to them, but the Ritva says, okay, so as a Midas Chasidus, maybe don't go into that kind of work, but, other than not having Eliyahu Navi talk to you anymore, and how many of us does he talk to anyway, it would be okay to get involved in that line of work. I remember when my sister, after she graduated from Cardozo, and obviously had lots of jobs available for her, she actually did, but she was considering whether to go into the DA's office or whether to become defense attorney, become a governmentally appointed defense attorney. So I counseled her that it was better to work for the DA's office on this basis, based on the consideration that it's better to apprehend criminals than to get criminals off the hook based on a Riyata or a Mikabel. And she became an assistant district attorney for a number of years. So, you can blame me. What? That's in Pei Gimel and Baba Metzia, I think. Yeah.
Just as a question, in terms of halakha, there's sometimes loopholes
Well, here's the thing. Is it entirely true? Last time we were talking about the case of, what was his name? Ben Chama, the fellow who had committed some sort of a capital crime, and he came in front of the Reish Galusa, and Rav Papa was, arguing in his favor and managed to get him off the hook. So there's a whole question there as to whether the gift that was given to Rav Papa constituted Chochet or not, or why he didn't constitute Chochet. But nobody criticized Rav Papa's conduct to try to get him off the hook. So it's also important to bear in mind we have a principle of Hitzilo Ha'eda. And certainly, when you're dealing with the Jewish parties, at the very least, that would seem to be, encompassed within, general principles of what is considered to be a worthy cause to help people, if there is some legal fashion in which they're entitled to get off the hook. So to find an argument in their favor, the Gemara in Nidan and Samach Aleph says that you're not allowed to harbor a criminal. That's the simple interpretation of why Rabbi Taflin didn't want to harbor these B'nai Galila who were accused of murder. because you know it's not proper, says Rashi, to harbor a criminal. And even Tosos, who says they're worried about getting into trouble themselves, the Maharshal there explains in the Maharshal in the back that it's only because there was a suffix as to whether they were guilty. But if you know that somebody is absolutely guilty, so you're not supposed to harbor a criminal. That would be one along the lines of Yatar Mikabecha. But let's say that according to the laws of the land, you can actually get the person. Or not that you're trying to provide the person with a safe harbor or with a place of refuge where they can be a fugitive from the law. But you're going to deal within the system of the law. And within the system of the law, you're able to utilize all of the legal principles that are set up legitimately within a legitimate system of criminal justice for purposes of ensuring that there be due process and that there be a fair system for everybody. And you're using those principles that are part of that fair system to help somebody get off. So just as Bitzilo Ha'eda is a general proposition within the halachic legal system, is not considered to be a problem. In fact, it's even considered to be something which is laudable. So it's not clear to me that you could not justify being a defense attorney even within a foreign legal system that operates according to fair principles that based on similar considerations.
So going back to the example you may have mentioned before, if there's a certain seizure without the warrant.
So I think you can make a reasonable argument that it would be based, would be legitimate to make those arguments. I mean, obviously, yesh chokin b'davar, but it just seems to me, having thought it through, I mean, forget it, you know, my sister already embarked on her career path, but, you know, having thought it through, I think one could make, you know, such an argument. She doesn't, you know, do that kind of law either anymore anyway. She made Aliyah many years ago, and mostly she does real estate contracts in Beit Shemesh. But, you know, certainly... She did have her assistant district attorney period before she got married and made Aliyah. So anyway, those are some of the you know considerations you know with respect to you know the day to day you know representation. Obviously, there are other considerations that are completely separate and distinct from the halachic discussion of Orchei HaDayanim that relate to the secular practice of law that have to do with other types of considerations as well when you're dealing with people who are doing things that are not alpi halacha, and there you have lifnei iver considerations. That comes up a lot in corporate law if you're representing parties who are charging interest, for example, where you have to deal, you know, if you're actually drafting the contract, so you're actually over on ribis, if you're just advising them, so you're over on lifnei iver, and you got to figure out how to get around those things, and it's not always so simple to get around them. If you rely on Rav Moshe that, you know, there's no interest, halakhically speaking, that you have to worry about that are paid by corporations, if you're a big, you know, Wall Street attorney, generally speaking, you're not dealing with individuals, but corporations, even the guarantors of your contracts are going to be corporations and not individuals. But if you have individuals in the mix, either as the debtors or the guarantors, so then you have a serious issue if they're Jewish. If both parties are Jewish, you have those issues. If you're just counseling the party, you could generally knock down lifnei iver to misayeya if it's chadiv v'dinara, and according to the Dougal Meravava, you can knock it down to mumer status. You put together the shachal and Dougal Meravava that if a mumer is mutter, and if you're a mumer even ledavar echad, and that move davar echad happens to be that this person always is over on ribis, and it's there are arguments to be made, but I don't think that lechatchila one should you know look to be in those types of situations, which is why it's generally better if you're going to be a corporate attorney to be a corporate attorney for a big firm where your clients are going to be corporate entities and often not Jewish entities as well, where you're not going to be in these types of mom and pop situations. If you are a small town lawyer and you're dealing with the Jews in your neighborhood, and there are, and some of them may not be so firm, and there are interest transactions, I don't think that it's so easy to make the issue go away, and I don't think that it's so pusher to you know accept these types of assignments or clients on that basis. But those are some of the considerations. So let's now move on to the actual litigation. So when it comes to the actual litigation, does this present like a different sort of problem, halakhically speaking, to represent somebody? So here, you know, it's not even here that, here you deal with dealing in two dimensions. One dimension that you're dealing with is the dimension of ISSA. The other dimension you're dealing with is the dimension of, does it even work? doesn't even work. There's a discussion about appointing a morsha, about appointing somebody who's going to actually represent the party. The Gemara in Baba Kama Daf Ayin clearly, you know, indicates that only a Toveya can appoint a morsha. Only a Toveya can appoint somebody to stand in for him. That's because sometimes you'll have Nechassim, which are Medina Sayyam, they're far away. You don't have the ability to go and to litigate yourself. So you give somebody else, really, what's a morsha? He's like a Yipay Koch. He has the power of attorney. I mean, there's an actual Nusach of Harsha, where you're giving over the right to collect the claim and the rights to the claim to this other individual so that they're able to stand in for the Toveya, and this is considered to be legitimate when the person wouldn't have been able to access the assets otherwise. Even there, the Gemara in Shavuos and Daf Lamed Aleph quotes the pasuk in Yeschezkel, Vashilo Tov Aso B'tzoch Amav, that a person acted improperly within his nation, Rav Mazeh Haba B'Harsha. And Rav says, you know what this is referring to? This is referring to somebody who comes with a Harsha. That's not considered to be a good thing. As Tosfos says, Kishe'oise B'Shoshu Ilem, that the person is, you know, a tough guy, Uval Tainos, and he's able to, you know, make really, really effective arguments, intimidating the other side. Shimsa'abe or Riv Lolo is getting involved in a quarrel that is not shayach to him. However, if you're serving as a morsha because you're helping somebody retrieve money, you'll eventually reconcile, you know, with the person, whatever you were able to get through your power of attorney, and you'll give it back to him, and, you know, you'll work that out afterwards as a separate transaction. But since you're doing a mitzvah to help the person get their money back, so then it's appropriate to come with a harsha. But otherwise, says Tosfos, if the idea of the harsha, I mean, there are different ways of understanding this, Tosfos. This is the way, Shavuos, Daf Lamed Aleph, Amud Aleph, this is the way the Shach seems to understand the Tosfos, and the way, and the Chazon Ish, elaborates upon this in I think it's Simon Gimel Sif Tesvav in Choshen Mishpat. So the Chazon Ish, that what Tosfos is saying is that it's only okay to serve as a morsha if you're really helping somebody retrieve assets that rightfully belong to him, but otherwise he wouldn't have been able to get it. So that's a mitzvah ka'avit, similar to the Yam Shel Shlomo consideration in the context of counseling somebody in the midst of a dispute. But if you're doing it because, and again, this is the Shach's interpretation, the Chazon Ish, that the morsha, you know, from Tosfos it's not clear who's the olam and the Baal Tainos. Not entirely clear from Tosfos, but he says if the morsha, the idea is that you're appointing the person as the morsha, as the having the power of attorney, because he's so effective, because he's going to really intimidate, he's going to scare, you know, the daylights out of them, so that, you know, even if maybe they would have had a good argument to rescue themselves, and they would have otherwise been able to speak up effectively in the context of a din Torah, they're not going to be successful in this instance, because you've hired somebody who's really... he's a morsha, but he's really a lawyer, and he's really, and you really called on him because he's such a good Baal Tainus, because he's so eloquent and forceful and intimidating. So then, that's not considered, you know, to be proper. It's interesting when, as I mentioned, when I started out in litigation, I started my law firm. So my first year, I was a litigator, and they put me on a shareholder derivative suit, and that's a suit which is brought by individual shareholders to argue that a company that merged with another company didn't properly look out for the best interests of the shareholders. So even if most of the shareholders are perfectly happy, all you need is a couple of guys to bring a class action suit, and they have these shareholder derivative suits all over the place, and if it could then be found that the transaction was not conducted properly and the merger was not in the best interest of the shareholders, so there's a certain amount of money that is generated as damage, and the lawyers collect a lot of money, and it gets split much less among the actual shareholders. So it's a good racket for attorneys. But in this particular case, we were representing the defendants in the case. And I did a lot of research in the case. It was my big summer associate assignment, and I found all kinds of evidence that this was definitely in the best interest of the shareholders. And I would keep track of the stock prices every single day, and the stock prices kept on skyrocketing after the merger. So we had a really, really strong case. And by the end of the summer, I was involved in the depositions and the briefs and everything. And it was wonderful. It was a great summer associate project because it started at the beginning of the summer, and the decision was handed down by the Delaware Chancery Court at the very end of the summer, and we won. And they were so pleased with my performance that they insisted on, you know, on hiring me full time. So Baruch Hashem, it worked out very well for me. But then afterwards, so when I came to, you know, to work for the firm afterwards, so So they put me back in litigation, figuring that, you know, this is, you know, a great area for me. But they put me on a case where I thought the other side was right. And it was a case where it was a product liability case, and our client had issued a product that, you know, people had suffered chronic illness and terrible damage, and mostly pregnant women, from taking this this product. And my job was to meet with some of the claimants. There were, like, you know, lots and lots of claimants, and we were trying to settle most of the claims with the claimants after hearing their side of the story and what happened to them, and figuring out which cases should go to litigation, which cases were worth our litigating over. And when I met with the claimants, one of my jobs was not only to assess the strength of their claim in terms of whether they took the product, whether they were harmed by the product, and so forth, but how easy it would be to rattle them on the witness stand. And if we came to the conclusion that it would be easy to rattle them on the witness stand, then even if they had a very strong claim, it would be more likely to litigate the claim based on the feeling that we can make them look really, really bad so that there would be less of a chance of recovery. So I went to my partners and I said, I can't do this. I don't feel comfortable with this notion of this, you know, type of learning. Say, but you were so good at the other guessing. Yeah, because our side was right. So that's when they realized I should go into a different field. So I went into corporate real estate instead after that. But this is kind of, you know, this is the principle. This is the operating, you know, principle, that it's okay, if indeed you're, assigning somebody just to collect the debt that rightfully belongs to you, but not if you're trying to, confuse and rattle the other party. That's what Tosfos is saying. And the Chazon Ish elaborates upon this, says sometimes when, this is, indeed, in Siman Gimel Tesvav, says V'yesh Lama the Kavanas Tosos the Baal Tainos Yachol LaHatrid Es Baal Din Es Abezdin. He says, firstly, you can confuse the Bezdin as well. Ves Baal Din Lefamim Mabe Besfekos Al Abezdin. He's going to confuse and rattle the Bezdin. Lefamim Shoge HaBaal Din Mitshuvaso, and cause the other Baal Din not to be able to respond properly. Al Tanos Shekenegdo Umischayev Bedin. And he says, even though it's the Einu Maklal Sheker, you're not lying outright, nonetheless, Umikom Makom, En Roy Lezeh, Shechari Petainos, it's not proper for somebody who's, you know, functioning in this fashion because of their Harifus, in making Tainos, Lisari B'Shel Acherim, to get involved in other people's disputes, Mikri Misaber Ariv Lolo. And that's what Tosis is talking about, as something which is frowned upon, as Misaber Ariv Lolo, when you're representing a party in the course of a litigation proceeding, even as a Morshin. Again, this is, we're talking only here about the Morsha for the Tovea, because there's a whole big discussion about whether a Nitba can appoint a Morsha altogether. And the Pashtus of the Gemara is a Nitba can't appoint a Morsha. There is a Yerushalmi in Sanhedrin that talks about a Kohen Gadol appointing an Antler. The word Antler doesn't appear, to the best of my knowledge, in Bavli, but it is an important word for this discussion, because that is one of the words that's used to describe kind of the halachic origins for the notion of lawyer's Antler. That appears in Sanhedrin. Talks about a Kohen Gadol, well done, and also that you don't judge you can't bring a Kohen Gadol to Bezdin. So what do you do, because it's beneath his covenant, so what do you do when a Kohen Gadol is a litigant? So it says, well, it's okay, you can appoint an Antler, except for the fact, well, then the Gemara says, but that doesn't work if there's a Shua that needs to be taken. So many Rishonim point out, so it sounds like that short of having to take a Shvua, as long as this person doesn't have to take a Shvua, it seems that even a Nitba would be allowed to appoint an Antler, let's call it. So it might not be a Morsha, it might be something else. So here's where we kind of get into a little bit of confusing territory. So on the one hand, as we said, Morsha has a very specific meaning. It means that you're assigning the claims to this individual, although it's quite clear by the time of Tosfos that everyone understood that's not what was really going on. But nonetheless, that was kind of the context in which the idea of a Morsha was created. But a Nitba doesn't have any claims to assign. You know, the Bezdin of America, we always put in the Shtar Beruin that the Tovea has claims against the Nitba, with each one having claims and counterclaims against each other. So we want to allow for the possibility of counterclaims. But Lemaise, it's the Tovea who has the claims. The Nitba doesn't have anything, you know, per se, wouldn't have bought the suit otherwise. So Nitba doesn't have anything to assign per se. And the halacha is paskin and Shulchan Aruch. We don't have to get into all the nitty gritty of this Rishon says this, you know, this Rishon says that. The Shulchan Aruch paskins that a Nitba doesn't really have the ability to appoint a Morsha. So that, you know, creates kind of a strange situation. So how do you explain the presence of individuals representing parties in Bezdin? And also, The whole idea of Morsha assumes that you have something in Medina Sayyam and you said somebody to represent you in Medina Sayyam. That's not the way that it generally functions in our litigation settings. You have the Baal Eid Din who are sitting there in court, and their lawyers are sitting there in court with them. So what exactly is going on? What exactly is going on over there? So what justification do we have for this notion of the fact that both the Tobeah and the Nippah are being represented, and they're being represented in cases where there's no harsha whatsoever. The client, even the Tobeah, is not assigning the claims one way or another. The Sman, the Shach say different things here. The Sman Yud Zayin and the Shach in Kufchav Dalid, the beginning of Simon Kufchav Dalid. So the Sma says, well, with respect to the bringing people into the Din Torah, it's really okay because the Baal Eid Din are really making their presentations, and then they're just bringing along these other individuals to enhance their presentations afterwards, and that's why this has developed as something which is okay. And then he says afterwards, and even if it's done with the other parties representing them entirely, it's like Kiblu Alayu, that this is how the custom has evolved, so therefore it's like a Kiblu Alayu, that this is perfectly okay. What they say about Kiblu Alayu is Kiblu Alayu doesn't work if the Toveya says, I don't want to be Mekabel, this for the Nitba to be able to bring a Marsha. So Kiblu Alayu kind of has its limitations. But the Sma doesn't premise his first argument on Kiblu Alayu. The simple reading of the Sma is that he feels that it would be perfectly fine if they just say things at the end of the presentation. Now what I didn't say, which I need to say, is that there's sort of the secondary role that could be played by somebody in the setting if they're not serving as a Morsha, so maybe they're doing, like the Sma says, of just enhancing the arguments and so forth. Is there a problem with that? Well, there could be, because there's the halacha that that you have to hear from the Edim themselves, right? According to the halacha, you have to hear from the Edim themselves, and lo mipi ha-mitorgumen, and you're not allowed to hear through through a translator. So the question is whether this halacha of Mipihem is a halacha that only applies to Edim, or this is a halacha also that applies to Baal Eid Din, that you have to hear from the Baal Eid Din themselves. It all depends to a certain degree on how you interpret a certain Gemara, Makos and Daf Vav. It talks about Hanu Lozi, where there were people who came for a Din Torah, and there was a Mitorgeman appointed, where it was really necessary, and so forth. But otherwise the Mitorgeman is not allowed, and there's a Machlokas Rishonim as to whether you understand that the case is only talking about Edim, whether the case is talking about Baal Eid Din, and whether there is some halacha that the Dayanim need to hear mipihem lo mipihem mitorgamon, even with respect to Baal Eid Din. The Rambam seems to hold that this halacha mipihem lo mipihem mitorgamon is not only a halacha with respect to Edim, but is even a halacha with respect to Baal Eid Din in Hilchos Sanhedrin. So that being the case, so we have a separate problem over here. We don't have just the problem of whether one can appoint a Morsha or not appoint a Morsha. We have a question of, let's say it's not really a Morsha, and it's not really a Morsha in most of the cases, Bizman Hazeh. It's a Toin Rabbani. Is this prohibited because of the fact that the Dayanim need to hear from the sides directly and not from an intermediary? Because there's a notion of being able to see the, as some of the Achronim say, the Akima Sifseim. You see the way that their body language, the way that their mouths are, are moving, the way that the words are coming out, that you get much more of a sense of the truth of the matter, the truth of the union, if you hear from the Baal Eid Din and you don't hear and you don't hear it through a third party, to an intercessor, particularly if the intercessor is, as the Chazon Ish says, a Baal Eid Tainus, somebody who really knows how to weave a good argument. So when the Sma and the Shach are talking, they're talking kind of in the context of both of these considerations, and they sometimes kind of get mixed together in weird ways. If we assume that halakha l'maisa, Tobeah can appoint a Morsha and not a Nitba, but when it comes to the secondary consideration, both of them are sort of on the same footing, right? That I have the same consideration of Mipiam lo Mipiam Mitorgamon with respect to the Tobeah and with respect to the Nitba, so then it should come out that that maybe, and the Sma says this actually in Hilchos Harshah, that maybe it should come out that if we're going to be Mekel, then it only really makes sense to be Mekel in a situation where the Baal Eid Din are not there altogether, and then it's a question as to whether about the kibul olayu even with respect to a nitba, but it doesn't make sense to be mekel when the bali din are there themselves and you're only listening from the toanim. For some reason, the sma seems to be comfortable with the notion that yes, that would be a problem, but it wouldn't be a problem if the toanim only speak at the very end of the din Torah after the bali din are done, so that the sma appears to be more comfortable with, although it's not entirely clear why. Maybe because the bezdin had the chance to hear from the bali din, and this is only kind of like an afterthought. It's only like an epilogue, so maybe, you know, that would be less problematic. And the shach goes on and on saying that in this kind of situation, which is not really a morsha situation, it shouldn't really matter. Either you allow it for both, or you allow it for neither. But it's not a morsha situation. It doesn't make sense to have it for one and not for the other. And then the shach says, therefore, that's why our practice is that we always allow it for the tovet and not the nitba. The chazaner says, huh? How did you get to that conclusion after that discussion? It doesn't make any sense at all. So the chazaner says that what the shach concludes with, this is in the chazaner Simon Dalid Siv Zayin, just doesn't make any sense whatsoever, and the only way to really justify the practice that we have nowadays, says the Chazon Ish, of allowing both parties, he says, to allow a morsha, fine, I'm perfectly comfortable with the notion, give the Tobeya a morsha, don't give the Nippa a morsha. What we do, in terms of having these advocates or helping out with the presentation, that should all depend upon the Kabbalah. If the parties are Mekapalit, good. If the parties are Mekapalit, not good. Even this is questionable, because it really should be the Bezdin that is Mekapalit in the end, because it's the Bezdin's responsibility to hear directly from the party. So why would the Bezdin ever have a justification not to hear directly from the party? So here is where you have the next consideration, which is mentioned by the Gemara, it's mentioned in the Rambam. The Rambam mentions this in Hilchos Sanhedrin Perichot Aleph Halacha Yud Aleph. Says, let's go back to, you know, the first problem that we discussed. First pshat of Rashi. Zion himself can't serve as an Oer Din. He's not allowed to, you know, to help out the parties one way or another. What if the Dayan sees that, you know, one of them really has merits to his case, but he's not able to get it out of his mouth. He wants to be able to say it, but he just can't put the words together. He's not articulate. He's not able to, clearly explain himself. Or the Dayan saw that this party was struggling to be able to answer the claims and the allegation have been made against him, but because of his tremendous emotions and his anger and just his vulnerability during the litigation proceeding, Nistalik Mimeno, he's not able to know what to say. So he's not able to get out the words or the ideas clearly enough. So in such a situation, you can help him out. Who can help him out? Even the Dayan can help him out. Matt, a little bit. Lahavino tachilas adar, to help to steer him at least in the right direction. Mishum psak pichalilem, because we have another consideration. That other consideration is called psak pichalilem, not olam ilem. That you have to try your best to open up the mouths of the mute, of those who are unable to express themselves. It's talk lisiyashi b'dor zehabe. Rambam acknowledges this is very difficult. On the one hand, we've told you al tasas b'kerachei adayanim. We're talking about the dayanim here. On the other hand, we're telling you psak pichalilem. These are kind of contradictory principles that militate against each other. So therefore, he says, "It's talked be very careful about this, so you're not going to be like the Orchei Hadayanim." Well, if this is the case, so now we can go back to our scenario of the Bali Din, who are bringing their Tonim Rabbanim in front of the Bezdin, and we could say, well, maybe we can find the situation where even from the perspective of the Dayanim, it would make sense for the Dayanim to allow for such a Kabbalah, and maybe even to demand such a thing in certain cases. When the Dayanim feel that there is, that the parties themselves are unable to articulate themselves clearly, or that there would be perhaps a disadvantage in favor of one party, because that party is able to speak more coherently and eloquently than the other party. So then, if the Dayanim themselves are allowed to serve in this capacity, it actually stands to reason that it would be even better if the Dayanim would appoint or allow other individuals to serve in this capacity, if their capacity was simply to help the parties be mechaber hadvarim, to organize their presentation and make a more coherent and cogent and articulate presentation before the Dayanim than they might have done otherwise, which is why the system that we have in place, both at the Beis Din America and at the CRC Beis Din, actually is very mistabi, because what system do we have in place over there? We don't allow Tohanim Rabbanim. We don't allow Tohanim Rabbanim for the reasons that we've said, that the Tohanim Rabbanim, first of all, don't have clear authority according to Halacha. Secondly, often they are exactly these Baalei Merivos, these people who are only going to protract the hostilities, and they're only going to intensify the ill feelings between the parties. And even when there could have been a settlement otherwise, if Ezra Batsi writes this, that they take away from the whole purpose of Adin Torah, which is Emes Mishpat Shalom Shiftu B'Sha'arechem. Even when there could have been Shalom, they're just interested in prolonging the Adin Torah as long as possible. They'll collect their fees. They'll, you know, show off their talents. The longest Dinei Torah, a Dinei Torah that have these Tohanim Rabbanim. And not only that, but they're completely unlicensed individuals. So if they act unscrupulously, you can't do anything to penalize them for future cases. At least in Eretz Yisrael, they're licensed individuals. So what do we allow? We allow regular attorneys. What's the advantage of allowing regular attorneys? First of all, you have to allow regular attorneys, because if you don't allow regular attorneys, your decisions are going to be overturned. In fact, there was just a case in New York 2 years ago, I believe, called Kahan versus Posner, I think was the name of the case, where the Beis Din said to the parties, you can bring attorneys, but they have to be on our approved list. If you want to bring an attorney who we don't approve, then we're not going to let you bring an attorney. And one party wanted to bring a certain attorney. What was complicated about this case was that this attorney also fancies himself as a Tohen. The Tohanim don't really recognize him as a Tohen. He kind of views himself as a Tohen. But this attorney, he's a perfectly competent person. So this attorney was recommended or suggested by one of the parties. And the Beis Din said, we're not going to allow you to bring this particular attorney. And then the decision was handed down. The person didn't lose, but they didn't win as well as they wanted to, which also in many people's minds is considered to be a loss. You know, you bring a case for $1 million, you only get $500,000. That's a terrible loss. So they moved to actually overturn and to vacate the arbitration decision of the Beis Din. And the court ruled that it was null and void, because you cannot waive the right to an attorney, and the Beis Din did not allow the parties to bring the attorney that they wanted. So you could see, even though they allowed them to bring an attorney, but since they didn't allow them to bring the attorney that they wanted, and even though they signed the waiver for it, but since the waiver is not something which, according to secular law, is binding forever when it comes to the waiver of an attorney, therefore the decision was actually struck down in secular court. So in order for the decision of the Beis Din to be enforceable, the Beis Din has to allow the parties to be represented by licensed attorneys, even if the Beis Din didn't want to. But there's another halakhically valid reason why attorneys make sense, and that's because of Psak Pichali Ilay, because the attorneys are doing precisely what the halakha would want a representative to do. They're not arguing the halakha, they're not trying to skew the facts of the case in order to fit into the halakha, because that's not their specialty. Their specialty is just the two... Well, maybe they're trying to, but they're not very good at it if that's not their specialty. So they are, what they do, in my experience, what they do is that they help the parties organize their presentation. They're not arguing halacha. The lawyers don't argue halacha in front of the Beis Din. They just present a much more coherent and well-organized and well-structured, well-orchestrated factual presentation before the Beis Din. And this is much more along the lines of Psak Pichal Ilem. All that being said, many poskim say that nonetheless, it's still appropriate to see to it that you also hear from the Baalei Din themselves, because there is this Mipim Lo Mipim Mam Togum on consideration. So even if you're going to maybe throw in a little bit of the smaz consideration of, yeah, well, it's okay as long as you're supplementing the presentation of the Baalei Din with other people, even the supplement, which is through the mechanism of Psak Pichal Ilem, should still be a supplement. It still is important as much as possible to hear from the Baalei Din themselves, so you can note the facial expressions and the body language and some of the truth-telling concerns that might only emerge from examining the parties themselves, or rather than hearing the presentation from the attorneys. So that's the explanation of the Beis Din practice. It's interesting, the Mechaber of this, we have a couple of Sfarim called Seder Adin in the Beis Din room. One of them is written by Eliyahu Shochet Min. It's a much more of a kind of, standard scholarly or academic presentation, but it happens to be very, very good. And the other Seder Adin, which is also very, very good, is written by a mechaber named Rav Derber Medicker, or some version or variation of that pronunciation, who's the mechaber of the Sefer, and he writes in his Bezdin is called Bezdin Hayasha Behatov. I'm wondering if that's the same Bezdin that puts out the Svarma Yashar Tov, is it? They like put out the Svarma Yashar Tov. It's a very nice set of Svarma of different like Bezdin cases and so forth. Do we have it here? Yes. We do have it here. Okay, fine. So we could check and see if it's the same, Bezdin. So he says that in his Bezdin, called Bezdin Ayashar Ve'atov, they do not allow for attorneys, except for very exceptional cases where they feel that the appointment of attorneys is appropriate based on the consideration of Safi Khalilin. So he actually has this principle explicitly articulated that it's not something which is generally appropriate, but based on the consideration of Psak B'Klilem, it could be appropriate under in certain circumstances. I'll just end. It's an Eretz Yisrael. I think he means Tonim Abanim. He means Tonim Abanim. I assume that the attorneys, they have to. Eretz Yisrael operates differently, as we all know, and the mutual respect and deference that's given to the different legal systems is not necessarily as taken for granted over there. So I'll just end with a tshuva by Sternbach, and the tshuva is Van Hagos, because I think it's just an important part of the discussion. I didn't mention, I'll mention just in passing, the Mechilta that's quoted by the Torah Tumim and Parshas Mishpatim, Minayin L'dayin Shlo Yamid Etzlo Senegorin, Tamin Loma Ad HaLokim Yabo Dvar Shnehem, the Lashon of Mechilta Shlo Yamid Etzlo sounds a little bit like a Dayin Shino Lau Fatonim Abinim. Torah Shlema, Miluim, Simon Lamed Aleph gives three different explanations of this Mechilta. The Torah Tzmima has a whole discussion in which he uses this Mechilta to say this is a basis for not allowing Tohanim and that it's really consistent with the Gemara and Shavuos, but it's not because the Nusach that he has of the Gemara and Shavuos doesn't really exist, but okay, that's just a Mara Mokum. But the Tshuvas Van Hagos, says something which is just very important to this discussion. I'll end with this, only a couple of minutes after the 4:15 time that I promised, which is, V'nei Hinagu Ayom. The minhag nowadays is shigam nipa shalech nitzig orech din. Even the nipa sends along a toin rabbani mitamo. V'nira atam. Why is it that we're allowing not only from the toveya but also the nipa? Says v'nira atam nehove hayom ein donin din tovah mamish. Since nowadays, we're about the din. It's not real din tovah. Yeah, if we're talking about the halakha is din tovah, so fine. We could have had the discussion that we just had. But that's not what's going on. Like ikra psaka begad pshara. Everything is pshara. Pshara, anything goes. Haneris the dayadim kaserek v'yashir. Okay, in a medakta game is a v'chol tikduke mishpat. Therefore, when I'm medakta, I can only tikduke mishpat. This is not muskum from all the post game that pshara doesn't require the same tikduke mishpat. I'm just reading you the charos for an hagos. Ulechein lo makpidim gam minipa kishishalek toin v'abini afsheinim ofia be'atzmo klal. Even if he doesn't show up at all, the real marshal. Umikom okam yesh skos lebeisden the drosh hofas abaldin atzmo. The beisden has the right to insist that abaldin appear himself as well. If they feel that it's really, really important. Aval, but he goes on to say, you are particularly good, Toin Rabbani. And the other guy is somehow fumbling and stumbling because he's not able to overcome this fellow sophistry. So then the Dayanim should silence the Orech Din. Then they should not allow it under those circumstances. This, as we know, doesn't happen. And make sure that the second side has a towing that's on the same grade. One guy has a grade A towing, you can't just allow the other fellow to have a grade B towing. They have to be on the same general level. Now we just throw this in. It says, if it's not just Pshara, but a place where they agree to Pshara Ke'in Din. I don't know if he means by that Pshara Krovaladin. If he means Pshara Krovaladin, and he's saying Pshara Krovaladin should have more than the general procedural requirements of a regular Din Torah, so then you wouldn't necessarily have this heter, because generally speaking, our Bati Din function in accordance with Pshara Krovaladin. That's what's officially on the Shtar Beirurin. But very, very interestingly, he does say that if it is Pshara Pshara, so he thinks that would be another heter as well, for the use of Toein Rabbani Bisman Azim. However, he does go on at some length about the importance of silencing Toein Rabbani, who's going to cause the other side to be completely discombobulated. And unfortunately, you do see sometimes tactics that could be described in the realm of intimidation tactics, you know, from time to time. Not to say that regular lawyers are not immune to this, but if a dayanim see that either a Toyin Rabbani, if they allow it, or a regular lawyer is engaging in this type of tactic, so then it is very appropriate in our system of justice for a dayan to jump in and not to allow that type of exploitative behavior, because we feel that it's going to be much more difficult to be done in Emes Lamito under those circumstances. Okay, we'll stop here. And Yetzer Hashem, the next time I'll be in town will be Tuesday, February 18th. It's 3 weeks from now, so it's a shorter hiatus than usual.
Okay.
Tuesday, February 18th. He said, well, Kol Shekein, that you shouldn't allow these shenanigans since Pshara Kovel Adin. He doesn't say Pshara, or Pshara, he uses Lashem Pshara Kein Din. But, yeah, he says, he doesn't give an absolute psak as to whether he feels his heter wouldn't be applicable at all to that type of situation.
There's Mipiyam, Elohim, Mipiyam, and Torgamon. You also have Mipiyam, Elohim, Mipiyam,
Ksavam. Right.
And Shofar says that by the Valley Din, if they both of them are Mekal, or Kibulayu, they can submit the Tanya's Piksa. So why would it be different by Mipiyam, Elohim, Mipiyam, and Torgamon if they're Mekal, and like you're saying,